Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
Good morning. Good.
Do we have the right time, 11:15 or 8:15?
Yep.
Okay. As we mentioned last week, we take a look at the chapter in the Guide for Perplexed. It was just to refresh. So we were discussing the false notion of God having to contract himself to make room for the universe, meaning the pantheistic view where God fills up all space. And part of that view is saying that God is occupying space. Because filling up all space can only be if you say that he's physical in nature. And the problem with that, we refer to Maimonides, where he talks about, he criticizes Aristotle's view of how the universe, the substance of it, the matter, had to exist eternally, meaning it always existed. So both Plato and Aristotle have that view, where the Torah's view is that the existence of the earth came from non-existence. The existence of the universe, I should say. So there was nothing, and then God created it from nothingness. But the problem, he says, is because what forces a person to into this position, the eternity of matter, is because they look at matter now, and they see how things come into existence. They don't just come into existence from nothingness. Something is generating it. Meaning a previous member of that species causes offspring, or a statue is not created from nothing, it's carved, it's sculpted out of a pre-existing substance of marble or something. So based on how a person sees the universe now, they make the assumption that these are the properties that the universe always had. And that's exactly what Maimonides takes up. So if you have the guide, if you take a look at it, it's book 2, chapter 17. So let's read a bit and see if we can understand his points. Okay. And he starts as follows, and he says that everything produced comes into existence from non-existence. Even when the substance of a thing has been in existence and has only changed form, meaning like, for example, a sculpture or the offspring of a certain species. So that means that the semen and the egg was in existence, and then the offspring now comes into existence from that. So he says again, even when the substance of a thing has been in existence and has only changed its form, the thing itself, which has gone through the process of genesis and development and has arrived at its final state, has now different properties from those which are possessed at the commencement of the transition from potentiality to reality, or before that time. Take, for example, the human ovum that's contained in the female's blood when still included in its vessels. Its nature is different from what it was at the moment of conception, when it is met by the semen of the male and begins to develop. The properties of the semen in that moment are different from the properties of the living being after its birth, when fully developed. So he's giving an example of how at conception, the human being is in one form, and at birth, it's at a completely different form. So his point that it now has different properties from those which are possessed at the commencement of the transition. Okay, so it's clear. The child has different properties than it had at the beginning when it was first being conceived. It is therefore quite impossible, and here's his point, it is therefore quite impossible to infer from the nature which a thing possesses after having passed through all stages of its development what the condition of the thing has been at the moment when this process commenced. So number one, he's saying that you can't look at something now and assume based on its current status, its current properties, what properties it possessed the moment when this process commenced. That's number one. So that means going all the way back to the beginning, you cannot extrapolate based on what you see now. Number two, he says, nor does the condition of a thing in this moment show what its previous condition had been, meaning even if you don't go all the way back in time, but any previous state cannot be extrapolated from what you see it now. Just because you see an object in a certain state right now does not in any way mean that that's how it always was. So this is his primary point. And he says further, if you make this mistake and attempt to prove the nature of a thing in potential existence by its properties when actually existing, you will fall into great confusion. You will reject evident truths and admit false opinions. Again, what he says now is that if you make this mistake and you attempt to prove the nature of a thing in potential existence, that means when it's not existing yet, but if you want to prove the nature of something when it not yet existed, meaning at its very beginning, but the properties when actually existing, that means you're looking at something now, he's repeating his point. If you look at something now and now you want to extrapolate back to how it was in its potential, you will fall into great confusion and you will reject evident truths and admit false opinions. Now he gives an example. Let us assume in our above instance that a man born without defect had after his birth been nursed by his mother only a few months. The mother then died, and the father alone brought him up in a lonely island till he grew up, became wise, and acquired knowledge. Suppose this man had never seen a woman or any female being. He asks in person how man has come into existence and how he has developed, and receives the following answer. Quote, man begins his existence in the womb of an individual of his own class, namely in the womb of a female, which has a certain form. While in the womb he is very small, yet he has life, moves, receives nourishment, and gradually grows till he arrives at a certain stage of development. He then leaves the womb and continues to grow till he is in the condition in which you see him. End quote. So the orphan will naturally ask, quote, did this person, when he lived, moved and grew in the womb, eat and drink and breathe with his mouth and his nostrils? Did he excrete any substance? The answer will be no. Undoubtedly, he will then attempt to refute the statements of that person and to prove their impossibility by referring to the properties of a fully developed person in the following manner. So the child will now say, the orphan will say as follows. When any one of us is deprived of breath for a short time, he dies and cannot move any longer. How then can we imagine that any one of us has been enclosed in a bag in the midst of a body for several months and remained alive, able to move? If any one of us would swallow a living bird, the bird would die immediately when it reached the stomach, much more so when it came to the lower part of the belly. If we should not take food or drink with our mouth, in a few days we should undoubtedly be dead. How then can man remain alive for months without taking food? If any person would take food and would not be able to excrete it, great pains and death would follow in a short time, and yet I am to believe that man has lived for a few months without that function? Suppose by accident a hole were formed in the belly of a person, it would prove fatal, and yet we are to believe that the navel of the fetus has been opened? Why should the fetus not open the eyes, spread forth the hands, and stretch out the legs, if, as you think, the limbs are all whole and perfect? End quote. So that would be the rejection of the orphan. This mode of reasoning would lead to the conclusion that man cannot come into existence and develop in the manner described. Okay, so he uses the example of seeing how a person exists now, requiring eating and drinking and movement and excretion. And this orphan will say, well, the way a person is now, he had to be that way always. He couldn't live without those functions for 9 months. Yet we know for a fact that that is the case. So here's a perfect example. We're looking at something in its current state, cannot be used to extrapolate how it existed in a previous condition. Maimonides goes on. And now he applies this principle, this rule, to the philosophers. And he says as follows. If philosophers would consider this example well and reflect on it, they would find that it presents exactly the dispute between Aristotle and ourselves. We, the followers of Moses, our teacher, and Abraham, our father, believe that the universe has been produced and has been developed in a certain manner, and that it has been created in a certain order. The Aristotelians oppose us and found their objections on the properties which the things in the universe possess when in actual existence and fully developed. See, he says that the Aristotelians, they oppose us because they're basing their objections on what they see the universe's properties are now, fully developed. So we reply, we admit the existence of these properties, but hold that they are by no means the same as those which the things possessed in the moment of their production. And we hold that these properties themselves have come into existence from absolute non-existence. Their arguments are therefore no objection whatever to our theory. They have demonstrative force only against those who hold that the nature of things at the present in existence proves a creation. But this is not my opinion. Okay. One second. Okay. All right, so far so good? Okay, I will now return to our theme, to the description of the principal proofs of Aristotle and show that they prove nothing whatever against us. Since we hold that God brought the entire universe into existence from absolute non-existence, and that he caused it to develop into the present state, Aristotle says that materia prima is eternal, meaning matter, the primary matter. And by referring to the properties of transient beings, he attempts to prove the statement and show that the materia prima could not possibly have been produced. Meaning matter, everything that we talk about, meaning you could neither matter could neither be created nor destroyed. So over that primary substance, atoms, molecules, so on. So Maimonides says he is right, meaning in terms that it can't be, it could not have been produced, but he's going to qualify that, because of course we do hold everything was produced from nothingness. So Maimonides says that Aristotle is right, that the materia prima could not possibly have been produced. We do not maintain that the materia prima has been produced in the same manner as man is produced from the ovum. That we agree, meaning because man being produced from the ovum, from the ovary, from the eggs, and the semen, that's a transition of existing substance. Meaning it's a transformation of substance that already existed. So that we say is, one second. Right, he says that we do not maintain that materia prima has been produced in the same manner as man is produced, because we, according to the Torah, do not say it's a transformation. Matter came into existence from nothingness. But man is produced from something. And we also hold that it can be, again, in the same manner as man is produced from the ovum, and that it can be destroyed in the same manner as man is reduced to dust, meaning the materia prima is not something which you can eliminate based on natural law. You can transform matter, but they're right, scientists are right, matter can either be created or destroyed. But we believe that God created it from nothing, and that since its creation it has its own properties, meaning that all things are reduced, are produced of it, and again reduced to it. When they cease to exist, that it does not exist without form, meaning when you, when man perishes, so the body disintegrates, but there still is remnant, there's bone, there's dust, or it comes with nutrients and it goes into the earth, it's just transformed. It's not something which leaves existence. Okay. Okay. Its genesis is not like that of the things produced from it, meaning primary matter, the matter that came into existence from nothingness. So its genesis, its creation was not like that that's made from it. Again, he's saying there's a difference between matter coming to existence from nothingness and then things being existing, you know, coming to existence today, like a new tree. So a new tree is not coming to existence today from nothingness. It's something that it's generated from. Okay? But the material matter, the initial matter, has been created from nothing, and if it should please the Creator, he might reduce it to absolutely nothing. The same applies to motion. Okay, we'll skip the part of motion. I don't understand what he's talking here. I'm not familiar with this, with the principle. It seems to be his previous knowledge you have to have for this. Let's skip down. Okay, this is six lines from the bottom on page 180. So he goes back and he says, in short, the properties of things, when fully developed, contain no clue as to what have been the properties of the things before their perfection, meaning before they came into existence, or as they were developing. We therefore do not reject as impossible the opinion of those who say that the heavens were produced before the earth, or the reverse, or that the heavens have existed without stars, or that certain species of animals have been in existence and others not. I mean, we don't look at how the world is today and say that that's how it had to be always. Well, there's nothing that forces us to say that. Just the opposite, because of the example of the child. We said earlier, we see that the formation of something is one state, and when something's completely perfected in its formation, we cannot look at it in that perfected state, in its completely formed state, and extrapolate backwards and say that that's how it always existed. For the state of the whole universe when it came into existence may be compared with that of animals when their existence begins. The heart evidently precedes the testicles. The veins are in existence before the bones, although when the animal is fully developed, none of the parts is missing, which is essential to its existence. This remark is not superfluous if the scriptural account of the creation be taken literally. In reality, it cannot be taken literally, as will be shown when we shall treat the subject. So we should just make a note that I would like to take a look at that, if we could locate that. I'll see if there's no footnotes here, but maybe the Hebrew version has that. He goes on in the last paragraph. The principle laid down in the foregoing must be well understood. It is a high rampart erected around the law and able to resist all missiles directed against it. So the principle that he lays down is that looking at something now cannot be used to extrapolate back to how its properties were previously. Certainly not at its beginning. Aristotle, or rather his followers, may perhaps ask us how we know that the universe has been created and that other forces than those it has at present were acting in its creation, since we hold that the properties of the universe as it exists at present prove nothing as regards to its creation. So Maimonides is saying, he's giving credit, he's saying Aristotle might have a good question. If we're contending that seeing something now is in no way representative of how it was previously. So he could say Aristotle or his followers can ask, well, how do we know this? And how do you even know that the universe has been created then? Meaning if you're saying that you cannot look at something now and say that that's how it always was, so we're basing creation on that. Meaning something didn't always have to exist in this physical state. So Aristotle can lodge a question. Well, what gives you that information? Because if all you have right now is the current state of the current properties of existence, so why assume anything else? What is forcing us to say it is different? In the case of a human being, fine. There you have an example. You have evidence. But it would be a good question to ask against us, well, what's causing us to have this opinion? Outside of the case of the formation of a human or maybe similar things, well, let's take the universe. Why, who would say the universe has to go through that transition? That would be a very good question that Aristotle could ask us, because there is no evidence pointing that way, just looking at the world. So what would force us to have that position? So we reply, Maimonides says, there is no necessity for this according to our plan, meaning there's no necessity for us to prove it. For we do not desire to prove the creation, but only its possibility. And this possibility is not refuted by arguments based on the nature of the present universe, which we do not dispute. Meaning we don't dispute the nature of the world right now. But our position of creation is not rejected because how you look at the world right now, it looks like it always had to be this way. We've already shown that things can have a different nature based on the example from the child. So Maimonides is saying we're not trying to prove creation, but all we're trying to do is show there's a possibility, and that the arguments that, well, look at the way something is right now, it must always be that way, that's not a solid argument. So we don't have to look at the world right now and say it always was in this present state. So we're just saying there's a possibility. Since we see something else in existence, namely a human being, goes through a transition from being semen and egg to a fetus, and then finally a full-grown, independent, breathing and eating and excreting being, so that means that possibility can exist for other things as well. So that's what my mind is saying. We're just making one step. If something like that exists, that type of a model exists in the human being, that could possibly exist in other things as well. So all we're trying to do is show the possibility of creation. When we've established the admissibility of our theory, then we shall show its superiority. In attempting to prove the inadmissibility of creation ex nihilo, meaning in the attempt that the Aristotelians have to reject creation from nothingness, the Aristotelians can therefore not derive any support from the nature of the universe. They must resort to the notion our mind has formed of God. Their proofs include the three methods which I have mentioned above, and which are based on the notion conceived of God. In the next chapters, I will expose the weak points of these arguments and show that they really prove nothing. That's the end of the chapter. Okay. So this, as we said last week, is what we based on our discussion, that the view that people have of God having to make room for the universe is generated from an inability to accept anything outside the physical. Since people are very attached to the physical, even the Jews at Sinai, they were forced to make a golden calf, because they just can't, they couldn't tolerate something abstract or something not in front of them. God, they accepted God, they accepted Moses, but they said, Moses the man who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. So they needed something tangible. So you see, even at that moment of receiving the Torah, that desire was so strong. And that's why God had told them, he told Moses to rope off the mountain, and he even warned the people twice not to try to ascend Mount Sinai when he created the phenomena, the miraculous phenomena. Because people will want to try to see something tangible regarding God. And God says, no, if you go up to the mountain, you'll be killed. Meaning if you express any type of concept, a notion in your mind that there's something to see concerning God, that's heresy. That's assuming God is physical, and he's not. He created the physical, so he is not physical. Now, when the Jews in Beit Shemesh, when the ark was being returned by the Philistines, after they were plagued by so many physical ailments when they stole the ark, so they finally said, we got to send it back. So when the Jews saw it coming back, they ran, they opened the ark, they looked inside, and God killed 57,000 Jews because they expressed a desire to see something in relationship with God, which is impossible. But you see how difficult that is, because people today will have this view that God had to contract himself to make room for the universe. And with the same way that is, they can't imagine God being in a completely different type of existence than the world. We see the world, it takes up physical space, and therefore God had to make room for it, because God's everywhere. God is physical in their mind, though. So that's the worst notion you can have. But you see, it comes, it's similar to this idea that Maimonides is talking about, that, you know, people will see something and will assume that this is how everything is always, even God. Okay, let me stop and see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah, Rabbi, what I'm thinking is all this was wonderful, what you told us. And basically, in reference to a person, a child, an infant, a fetus, all the beginnings were there to make the man, to make the woman. All the beginnings were there within the womb. And then it was able to grow outside and become who it became, you know, today. But with the beginnings of everything are the start of the item. The only thing that in reference to a person, but in reference to when Hashem made different things, he made it whole, he made it there, he made the Ten Commandments. He made it there. There wasn't a beginning like there was with a child. So there's different categories, but there is always a beginning that can, in reference to people, that can develop into who they are today. They had the beginnings when they were the very slightest, the semen and the egg.
I'm not understanding what your point is.
The point is that only in reference to people or animals, it's something that grows. It has the beginnings from the very start. And then it can develop into a human being. Whereas with Hashem created a mountain, Hashem created the seas. It's not like a person where it had to have a beginning.
You mean a transformation? You mean to say transformation, not beginning.
Transformation, yes, that's the
but
word.
How do you know that? How do you know that the mountains were just magically made in an instant? According to geologists, so there's evidence that mountains were created over tens of thousands, if not millions of years, by glaciers that were moving at a certain pace, and they carved out mountains. So mountains were not made instantaneously. As a matter of fact, you know, the entire world, we don't say, is only 5,700 years old. Scientists have already proved it's billions of years old, 15 billion years old or so. So things did go through a very slow process of, creation, not just human beings.
But it's not like human beings, that's what I'm trying to point out.
No, I'm saying it is like human beings. Just like human beings went through a process of transformation, so the universe too.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. Right. The human being and the animal is so complex.
Well, yeah, everything is. Everything God makes has to have the same level of wisdom.
Right, okay, so I'm wrong. I was taking it in a different direction. Okay. You're right.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
Rabbi, I understand a second error that seems to creep into this idea of contraction. It seems that it comes out of an idea that God is because God is the only power, that he must be actively operating within everything, including people, because if people had free will, then they would be having a power separate to God, they say. And that can't be. then God must be acting inside the person. This seems to be a secondary part of their argument.
Can you just give it to me one more time?
Other than the physical component, I understand that people who believe in contraction think that no power exists other than God, and if people are free will agents, they say, then they are powers other than God, and since that can't be, God is really active inside them. This is part of their pantheism. God has to be inside everything because they can't understand that anything acts outside of God's plan or will or power.
Right, that's true. And they also go so far to say, I think you mentioned that God is even occupies sin, and therefore we're not held accountable because since God is doing everything, it's not only that he's in everything, but he's doing everything. And this, you know, sort of like makes everything holy in their mind. But then I think you mentioned last week, so that would be a problem because when somebody does a sin, so there has to be God's will, so then how could they get punished? So it leads to absurdities, of course. Because once you start trying to force God into every imaginable thing, so you end up with falsehoods. But it's all stemming from their view of God as occupying space. And then even sin is something which is spatial in their mind. So God's inside the sin. So one, ludicrous idea is leading to another.
Does it start from a bad understanding of a metaphor? Is there a metaphor that was at the start of this and then they understand it physically? And then develop further thoughts that God is in sin because they don't understand the metaphor? Or did the bad understanding of God's incorporeality start the metaphor itself, or the doctrine, I guess?
I'm not sure where it initiated this specific idea. What was their starting point? Whether it was a false view of somebody just thought of, God is everything, they thought. Or the whole world is filled with his glory, which is a statement in the Torah, but then they misunderstood it. And again, the Torah says that it's not filled with him, but his glory, meaning his honor, evidence of his greatness is what fills the world. So that makes sense, but they misunderstand that. And there's other notions, too, that they have. They think there's a piece of God inside of man, and they take a verse from Job, and they completely distort it. There's a verse there that says that Job is telling his friends that he wouldn't sin, and he said that I would never look lustfully at a woman. If I'm trying to find a match for one of my sons, I'd look around for somebody who's a good match. A good fit for one of my sons, but I would never look lustfully, because what portion would I have with God if I would do so? So Job is saying that he wouldn't have an inheritance with God, meaning the next world. So some people take that, and they say the words portion with God, and they distort that to say that there's a portion of God inside of us. So it's a complete illiterate read of the verse. So there's many springboards that a person can use to make nonsensical ideas. I mean, the Christians, I think, also use the Shema. It says, "Hear, O Israel, God is our God, God is one." So the verse says God is one. But the Christians come along and say, well, if you count the times that the name God is used in that verse, it's three. And that proves the Trinity. So there's no lack of opportunity for people who want to be perverse and misconstrue things. You can take the simplest statement, right? They do that with Isaiah 53 to try to prove this story, when it's just the opposite They take something from the Torah and then they build it into a story about this individual. The Jews were referred to over there as being a collective whole, a unit, a single, a man. So you have that in other instances where a group is referred to as a single body. But they use that and they fashion that into a story about Jesus and being, you know, hurt for their sins, because really the people back then were looking at the Jews and they were saying the reason why the Jews are in this terrible state, it must be because of what we did, and they're bearing our sins. But that's not the Torah's, the Torah's not endorsing that idea. The Torah is merely reiterating the false view of the nations, just like in Koheles. King Solomon reiterates the false view of people in order to bring it out in the whole and then to show the problems with the view. So first you have to show the view. So the same thing over there. So there's really no shortage. I mean, there's many, many problems. Right, and Les is just online. He's just writing that. He's saying it's a good point that if God was in or part of sin, then that would indicate that he was part of that which brought about the flood, or brought about the destruction of Sodom. So, yeah, of course, it would lead to very foolish ideas. But people have these ideas because they started with the wrong point. So I'm not sure where it started from. It's a good question. But it seems to be a common theme. And based on that, I would venture to guess that when you have a common theme throughout, you know, thousands of years, and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of generations, I would say that the with the origin, the seeds of these false views is really man's psyche. And then he just uses, I mean, he has the internal need for something tangible in terms of God, because he can never outgrow that infantile state where he wants the mother, he wants something physical, he wants something superior to him, but something he can hold, something that he can envision, that it can fit into his idea of something that he can relate to. And based on that internal need, that psychological need that everybody has at youth, and all these people that don't outgrow it, so then they have, you know, numerous expressions. That's what idolatry is. It's the same exact thing, the expression of something tangible that's superior to me. And then, of course, there's many variations. But I would say, to answer your question, June, that the origin is really the psyche of man from youth, that people do not mature and abandon. But you see, I mean, my mind is a point over here. It's a very, very nice observation. That seeing something in its current state in no way indicates that it had any of these properties at its origin. So seeing the world now, and we see that things come from other things, does that mean that the world's always was this way, that it was always just mere transformation of existing matter? Its beginning could have had completely different properties. And that's what our point is to Aristotle. That's what Maimonides is saying, is our response to Aristotle when he says, well, if all you see is what the world is now, why would you, and there's nothing in the physical world pointing you to the fact that it came from nothing, what's forcing you to say that? So Maimonides' answer again is that we're not saying we have a proof. We're just saying it's possible, because we do see that the origin of man is completely different than his state after he's fully formed. So it's a very nice idea. You see that when you have discussions, when, you know, the great philosophers, the great thinkers, they had discussions with others. So it wasn't only the content that they would listen to, but they would also, I mean, this is just a tangential point, but it's important. I think I may have mentioned it at a different point that I was once discussing with a person who was brought up observant, and then at a certain point, he started questioning whether or not Sinai took place. And of course, that's always the point that a rebellious Jew takes up, because if he could get out of that, then the whole Torah would fall apart, and in his mind, he would be able to live without the obligation of keeping all the commands. So if he could somehow show that there's no real proof for Sinai when the Torah was given, so then in his mind, it frees him up. And one of the things they do is they look for just, they throw a barrage of questions at you. And if you can't answer one question, so to them, that's sufficient to now say the whole Torah is inaccurate. But in reality, you know, if you, let's say, you had a judge who was able to judge cases perfectly, time after time, 1,000 cases, the judge came up with the correct verdict and he proved his theories, and the innocent went free and the guilty were punished as it should be. And in one case, he couldn't conclusively prove something. So would it be sensible for a person then to discount the other 1,000 cases? Or would you say, all right, there's a question over here, but you have a track record. You have such a pristine record this judge had. I mean, he's got like the most reputable status. But that's not how a person who's a heretic is going to operate. The heretic has got an agenda already set. He wants to be relieved of his obligations of keeping the Torah. So in his mind, he's not using a rational approach like this case with the judge. He's looking for an excuse. And if he can have one question which doesn't get answered, that'll be sufficient. But there's also something else which is more important when you speak to them. You'll have to look at how they operate. You know, there's one, the statements that they make, they follow a certain path. So looking at how the person operates, and if they ask a question and it gets, and you give them a good answer, if they move on to another question, what it shows, you could see something in terms of how they behave. How come they didn't agree that they were wrong and they threw another question at you? The real intelligent process would be if a person made a statement, he sees he's wrong, he would say, okay, he has to acquiesce. But by going on to another question, you can illustrate to that type of a person, look at the path that you're taking, look at the approach you're using. You're just jumping from one thing to another when in fact you were just, you know, your proof was just rejected, so why did you accept that? That's one thing they do. But they also don't think that in this specific case, I was talking to this person, and he was rejecting that Torah was given at Sinai. So I asked him, what do you think about all these great minds, Maimonides, King David, King Solomon, prophets, Samson Raphael Hirsch, Nachmanides, all these great minds, they said that we have evidence. So he said, oh, they only believe that because they were brought up that way. That was his response. So he didn't think. So the response you give him is, number one, well, what did they actually say the reasons were? And you take a look, the Kuzari, Maimonides, you see that they didn't say that they brought up this way, but they give rational proofs of how you prove anything in history. And that's why they accepted it. So that's number one. You show him how he's going against the facts. But number two, this person himself was brought up religious, and he was able to abandon it. So I asked him, I said, well, if you were brought up religious and you are now able to abandon it, so why couldn't these people who were brought up observant able to abandon it? You're telling me that they just followed Sinai because they were brought up that way. So you're trying to say that it's like there's no free will? Since they were brought up that way, they just feel obliged to keep it out of habit. But he himself was not doing that. So that was the really best rejection. When you show the person that his very actions are contradicting the content of his argument. If he wants to say that a person is obligated and he's just following it because he was raised that way, well, what about you? You were raised that way too. So it's important that, you know, when you have these type of discussions, it's not a matter of just looking at the content and responding to the ideas or the notions that are being suggested. But also, just keep in mind, watch the person as they're developing their path of argumentation, and comment on that as well, and notice what they're doing, and point it out to them, because that itself, aside from their content being incorrect, can help you show them what they're doing, and when they witness it, they catch it. That could be a very helpful tool to them. So it's not just the content, but their behavior, their mode of questioning, or the contradictions that they're in. That I think is very, very important. Here, though, in our go ahead.
I was curious as to whether the person was able to hear what you were saying.
This person, I don't think, was able to. There were pauses in the dialogue because it was through email, which showed me that I think he caught himself and he realized, and he really didn't have a good response. So it took a day for him to get back after that last one. When I told him that what you're doing is, what I want to do, number one, is take it out of a conversation about him and me, because that's really how he was working. He was making insults, and he said to me things like, oh, that's the type of answer I would have expected from somebody in high school. So what I wanted to do is just get him entertaining if there could be a possibility to Sinai being true. And by doing that, to achieve that, I mentioned about Maimonides and all these great thinkers who did follow it. So that was number one, just to get it to be, let's see if he would just have the consideration. And you see, Maimonides does that here too. He wasn't trying to prove creation. He was just trying to show that there's a possibility of creation. That's what he says in this chapter we just read. You don't try to make a big argument that they'll just barrage you or they'll be too defensive about. Make one inroad and see if they can accept that. So that was what I was trying to do, but there was also the fact that when I showed him that what he was doing was a contradiction to what he was suggesting. He was saying these people were brought up that way, and that's the only reason why they accepted it. So when I showed him, well, you were brought up that way too, but you're able to reject it. So there was a big pause in the conversation. And then he came back, and he still just didn't respond to it. Because there is no response to that. That's a clear knockout blow. It's an obvious contradiction. So I forget the exact where he took it from there. But then I came across Maimonides, who quotes the Talmud and says that you should know what to answer the heretic, which is a quote from King Solomon. But the rabbis also say, but do not engage a Jewish heretic. That you should not do. And I was thinking the reason is because a Jewish heretic is one that has more mastery of the verses, and he'll just twist things around left to right, and you won't get anywhere. It'll be a waste of your time. So at that point, when I came across that Talmudic portion, I stopped the conversation with the guy. But I don't want to violate that. But at the outset, I wasn't aware of that. But as I got involved, I started investigating the area, I saw this. I said, oh, interesting. Don't engage a Jewish heretic.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rabbi Miller, may he rest in peace, answered a man while I was standing there and listening. The man said that he had a cousin, he was a Jewish man, he had a cousin who, excuse me, who was questioning him. He said, why did he become religious? He was about to, but he became religious as a Jewish man. And the cousin couldn't understand it. He kept twisting and twisting because they both had gone to Hebrew school together. And he twisted it to the point where the Jew, who was now observant, was confused and couldn't answer. And Rabbi Miller said, see, he's twisting everything so much that it's to the point where you're doubting yourself of what you learn. So that was one of the reasons why he said, don't talk to her, even a Jewish heretic.
Right.
Because it could disturb even what you know.
That's right.
Rabbi, so who would qualify as a heretic then?
A heretic would be a person who makes statements that violate the Torah, that go against the Torah. I think even if he says that one letter is not written by Moses, meaning he's questioning the divinity The Torah, any quantity of it, any quantity, even a letter, even a verse. Certainly a fundamental idea a person questions. Now, if a person's questioning something to learn, that's not a heretic. He's asking honestly. But if he's just rejecting it, you know, outright, so that's a heretic. There's a difference between asking a question and just saying patently it's not true.
Right.
Yes, Doug.
So, from our standpoint, it's Noahides, but I suppose the situation exists equally for the Jewish people. What do you do when you come across this whole array of rabbis, I guess, some of whom hold to, you know, a rational approach to Torah, and some of whom hold to what seems to be almost a fantasy approach to Torah? And I don't know if this was what Jim was getting at, but where do you, or is there any clear place where you sort of draw the line and say, okay, these people are totally off the wall and there's not any point in being involved with them, even though they have rabbinic credentials, and even though they have Orthodox rabbinic credentials?
Yeah, I mean, you have to assess it. If you see somebody is off the wall, so you distance yourself from them. Doesn't matter what title that they have. The bottom line is if they're saying things which you know are false, they're not thinking clearly, so distance yourself from them. Don't have any contact. It would be like anything. It's like, you know, anything which is damaging to a person, he stays away from, whether it's food or something contagious. So if you have people, I mean, the title doesn't matter at all. That's why, you know, a person has to be investigated. And Rabbi Mann once told me a statement of the rabbis, that they say, respect and suspect everyone. That means in terms of how you behave with a person when you first meet them, and, you know, you could always be, you know, civil and respectful. But that doesn't mean that you deny your senses when you hear them say things which are heretical. Like Jim was telling me at the Noahide conference, he heard things that were really just blasphemous. So forget it. These people should not be people that you're following. You should tell other people, warn them. I was actually discussing this with a friend yesterday that because I was speaking about something. I put something in the Jewish Times this week and about certain leaders and how certain people are liars, and he was asking me, you were being very harsh. So I told him, no, Maimonides does the same thing. Maimonides calls the idolaters liars, and the people that follow certain powers, like superstitions, he calls them liars too. He's very clear that that's what they're doing. They are spreading falsehoods. That is what a liar is. So he agreed that if that's the right, you know, appellation, that's what you give them. But I reminded him further of something that he reminded me of, and that is that in the beginning of the Maimonides commentary on the Mishnah, so he teaches a lesson, and he says that we derive from God our behavior, and God in the Torah warns us not to follow the Canaanites and the Egyptians and all false things. So God is pointing out people that are damaging, you have to stay away from them. And Maimonides says, we must do the same thing. If God is giving us license, in that case, to do the same thing and to warn other people that if there's people that are speaking falsehoods, and certainly they're speaking heretical notions, so you should warn other people not to listen to them. It's for their own good. So it's not only that you should stay away, but you should warn others.
Rabbi? Hello?
Yes.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah. But you said before, what Rabbi Jade said, respect and suspect, that sums it up.
That's Rabbi Mann.
But it doesn't... Oh, Rabbi Mann said that. Okay. That sums it up. It, in other words, that's giving you permission to understand that you're observing something. right?
Of course.
And of course, even dress doesn't mean just because somebody is dressed a certain way that they can be totally believed. Because
yeah, dress is nothing.
It could be put on.
Dress is not even an issue.
It's not even a consideration.
It's not a consideration at all. Of course not.
Right.
The Talmud in Tractate Chulin says that there was one rabbi who said that even if Joshua ben Nun said something, I wouldn't listen to him, meaning he was clear to himself on a certain point, and it didn't matter what the reputation of the person was. So that does not matter. That does not come into play whatsoever. But Doug, were you going to say something? I thought I heard you make a...
No, I'm so okay. Thank you. That clarification helped a lot.
I'm sorry, that was me, Rabbi. Actually, this wasn't what I was getting at, Doug, but now it does open up some other questions. So what is the proper method of warning people? You know, we do want to be respectful, so how do we...
Yeah, you have to be respectful to the people that you don't want, that they should be misguided. So your concern about other people is that if you hear, I mean... I don't know if you have to spend time proactively searching out and following where the speaking engagements are of, you know, certain people that are, you know, spreading lies or just ignorant. But, I mean, you hear about it, and if you know other people who attended it, see, clarify for them. You should tell the people. They should know for sure that certain ideas that were discussed are false. This is why they're false, and it's a better idea not to follow such people, because if this is really what they're, you know, what they're thinking, it's going to be tainting other things that they say as well. But it just shows a mode of thinking too, that, you know, it's representative not just of individual ideas that they have, and maybe other ideas are good. But if you see certain people, I mean, some people can make a small mistake about something, and that's it. All right, I misinterpreted a certain word in a verse. I thought, you know, it meant dog. It really means cat. All right, so that's not a problem the person's, you know, thinking. But if a person makes mistakes about God and justice, so he's got this concept where you know, God is inside of sin. So the whole concept of sin, this philosophy about the mitzvahs, is going to be completely tainted by that. You could see, you know, you could sense that this is much more far-reaching. And... you know, that would have to be gauged on an individual basis. You show genuine—the way you do it, you show genuine concern for your friends that they shouldn't fall prey to that, and explain to them why. Doesn't mean that you have to come to confrontation with the individuals themselves. The truth is that may be fruitless. A lot of times the person who has the role of a rabbi is going to be convinced that he's always right. And you also got a question. Why do certain people become the you know, the speakers at conferences? Maybe they had motivation to be in positions of authority. They enjoy that. We talked about that last week. You know, there's a reason why a person becomes a police officer. And not all the time is it for such pure motives. So teachers also, and in the name of teaching, they'll just say things that are thought through, and I remember once being in a lecture years ago, and the rabbi was talking, and he said, who can see further, a giant or the midget sitting on the giant's shoulders? So what he was trying to say, and he's not trying, he openly said it. He says, well, Rashi is a giant. And he says, I'm the midget. I'm smaller than Rashi, but now I've read everything Rashi says, and now I can see further. I know more than Rashi now. So he says, on the one hand, that Rashi's a giant. On the other hand, he calls himself the midget sitting on the giant's shoulders and claiming that he knows more. When this person is, and if he, it was like bothersome, really bothersome, how arrogant this person was. And I questioned him, and he became furious. Evidently, that fury is coming from an emotion that who can oppose me? I was merely an attendee of the lecture. So by that, that must have stamped me as being inferior to him. But you see from the response that how agitated it was, and he stormed out, that anybody that would confront him, it sort of like reminds me of Haman. You know, Haman had told everybody to bow down to him, and Mordechai did not bow down. He didn't even budge when Haman came close to him. And it bothered Haman so much. It was intolerable. Same emotion. A person can have the ego to such an extreme that if there's just one person who questions it, that it bothers him tremendously. The truth is, because he's really agitated, that maybe it's true. That's what bothers him so much. So he responds in the opposite extreme. But that really shows an insecurity. Yeah, but it's unfortunate. I mean, but the most we can just keep doing is being true to the ideas, going back to the source, and knowing and proving to ourselves what really is true, what makes sense, and sharing that with as many others as we can, and staying away. And in terms of whoever coordinated the conference for the Noachide conference, definitely I would speak to them and make sure that these individuals are not invited back, because based on what you told me, it was pretty bad news, pretty bad stuff that they were sharing, right?
Yeah, well, at least some of it was.
Yeah. Well, I would avoid inviting them back. Why risk? All right, any other questions or comments?
I'm here. Thank you, Rabbi.
Great.
Okay. All right, so we'll pick up back with Kohelis a week from today, same time then, all right?
Okay.
All right. So
Thank you.
Have a good week, everybody.
Good. Thanks, you have a great week, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.